Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, back in 1970, when the telly was still in black and white, a 25-year-old boy from the bush got off his tractor, picked up his guitar, and went to the Big Smoke, Melbourne. He stepped onto the set of Graham Kennedy's TV show New Faces and rolled out a tongue-in-cheek ditty about native birds. It was called Old Man Emu. The very first song he'd written, it went to number one for 5 weeks. Now, more than four decades later, that larrikin country boy is one of our national icons. With 3 ARIA Awards, 24 golden guitars, 36 albums, 350 songs, over 4 million album sales under his belt, you'll know him as Willow, Jono, the True Blue Man, or the Mallee Boy. He's, of course, John Williamson. He's here on Open House. Welcome.
Hi, Sharon. Nice to be in your open house.
Nice to have you here. We're just talking about, just off air before we went to air, just to, the way that you get around the nation. You have seen so much of it, and yet, to some degree, it's really between, you know, this gig to that gig and that gig to that gig.
And even going out searching for songs, you're really only driving along hairlines. I mean, if you have an aerial picture of Australia and worked out where you've been in your life, there's still only... You're still only following hairlines, aren't you? So you're not seeing much of it, really.
And yet, you probably have seen more than most of us.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I'd say so.
Yeah, and I guess that's why I have an overall picture of the country. You know, I'm not into patriotic attitudes. You know, I call myself an East Aussie. You know, because I started in the Mallee in Victoria and moved to New South Wales for most of my life, and I'll probably retire up in the mountains in Springbrook. So, you know, I'm an East Aussie, and... I have a lot of fun with that.
How do the Perth folks take you when you actually
I have fun over there. I tell them that, you know, I come over here, it gives me a chance to sing country and eastern music.
Boom, boom.
Yeah, it gets a laugh.
It was funny, you know, it's been a really interesting career, hasn't it? Because after you had that big hit in 1970, then there wasn't anything for a little while until really, really when True Blue came out, record-wise. I mean, obviously you were doing a lot, but in terms of, you know, the big kind of popular
persona. Oh, that's right. Well, it took me... Well, I think the best way to explain it is, firstly, I don't think I wrote good enough songs over that period. But also, the only really quintessentially Aussie kind of songs with an Aussie accent that were accepted in the 70s were silly songs, you know. So you had Pub With No Beer, not silly songs, but Knocking Ourselves Almost, you know, Time Your Kangaroo Down, Tongue in Cheek, you know, Emus Kicking Dunnies Down and Red Back in the Toilet Seat and all that. They're the only ones that seem to get airplay that were quintessentially Australian, you know. And so I was determined... After having the image of Old Man Emu, I really worked hard at trying to change that kind of image with my kind of songs anyway. And it wasn't really till Mallee Boy came out. I was changing it in fact, right out here where you are. I used to do the Blacktown Inn. I used to do little hotels all around the city of Sydney, Western Sydney especially. You know, if I do a series of Wednesdays over a month or something, I might get 10 people first week, 20 the next week. As long as I was doubling it, I knew I was getting somewhere.
Yes.
And it was during that period that I wrote things like Galleries of Pink Galahs, Raining on the Rock, True Blue, Mallee Boy, all that stuff, because I was determined that I was going to put out a purely Australian show.
Now, let's talk about that, because your music is purely Australian. The popular music scene in Australia is almost purely American. In fact, we have to have rules in radio to actually play a minimum of 20%, 25% Australian content, simply because there's such an avalanche of material from the US coming over. Have you ever felt the pressure? Did you ever feel the pressure at any stage to become more populist, if you want to put it like that, more American?
Well, the first, over that period, for me to get work, I did sing American songs. I didn't record them. I used to do a medley of Roger Miller. I used to do Johnny Cash songs, and I just throw a few of mine in. That was the only way I could get away with it. In fact, the agents would say, well, look, we're not interested in the original stuff, you know. And so I really had to fight for it, because all I had was Old Man Emu as a hit. You know, obviously that was the highlight of my show. Thank goodness I had that. But slowly but surely, it wasn't until I stopped doing the clubs and went into the pubs like I was talking about, I started doing my own material. You make your own rules there, and we were charging $10 on the door or something. So I was taking the punt. The pub were getting customers, you know, for their grog sales. You know, at one stage I felt a bit guilty that I was all about just selling grog, really, because you know, that's the only reason they'd have you there.
Right.
And almost if they're too attentive, they don't drink. The publican didn't like that either. So you had to have like commercial
song.
You had to have commercial songs or something in the thing to make them go away and have a drink. So do you do? prove to me that you've got to road test all your songs and make sure people really like them before you record them.
John Williamson is our guest on Open House. True Blue would have to probably be the best known song. Why do you think that it has resonated with Australians so much?
I think there's a huge degree of honesty there. I didn't, you know, obviously I sang as naturally as I could. You know, my kids used to get knocked for it at school, you know, "Hi, True Blue," you know, and all. But in the long run, I think that's the charm that people like, that it is so honest. And when you're talking about, you know, is it mum and dad, you know, is it me looking after your mates? Well, you're not going to, you got to be, sound like you mean it and sound like who you are. Mm-hmm. And after all, you know, people that I look up to, like Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson, for instance, and Slim, they've sounded like who they are. Mm. And, you know, I can't imagine why anyone can make it in the long run if you're putting on some sort of an act, if you like. You know, that's what a lot of the shows they used to call, the actor's on soon. You know, I thought, well, hang on, I'm not acting, this is me, you know.
That's really quite a profound thing in itself, isn't it, though? I mean, the fact is that if you want to be successful in music, really, you do have to fit a mould, you do have to fit a genre, well, do have to fit a market.
Yeah, well, I never have done that, so
you've
not
been,
really. I've always
broken that.
Well, I think I realised that Waltzing Matilda has always been a huge hit for Australians, and in fact, it's stronger now than ever, probably because of the sentiments in there. It's all about the battler, about our bush, the underdog, all these things that are still very important to Australians. And that probably goes right back to the convict days, you know. And so I always thought, really, what I want to do is write a whole lot more Waltzing Matildas, you know, if it's strong and it lasts forever. When they put up these competitions, ask people what is Australia's number one song, it often gets left out, but there's no doubt in my mind that Waltzing Matilda is our number one song. You know, there's no other song that's lasted as long, has got the history to it, and means as much to us, really. You know, it means more to us than our anthem, I think. And that's why you see people crying, you know, especially if you sing the sentimental version, which is the slow way I do it now. There are other versions. Also, I was brought up with, you know, Black Hills of Dakota and Oklahoma songs and all this sort of stuff. And I, you know, it's no wonder we found it hard to get out of out of this idea that you had to do American stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it was a long battle, but I've won the battle.
You won the battle. Yeah. A lot of artists would like to be following that in their own kind of way, following that pathway too.
Well, anyway, for them to follow their own, all they have to do is as who they are.
Yeah.
Just
but,
be who
but
they are.
But then they won't get work. Or they won't get some sort of, you know,
well,
audience.
I think that their songs are good enough, they will.
They will. So basically, just keep the faith. If you've actually got something that really is unique and you've got good songs, in the end, the art will win in the end.
And you have to be an entertainer. That's the bottom line. I was always an entertainer first. I didn't just sing songs and I have stories to go with them. I write comedy songs. And it's all part of, you know, you've got to make them laugh, cry, feel good about themselves. All those elements are in my show.
Where did that come from? Mum and Dad were both involved in theatre.
Well, they're both farmers, wheat farmers, but it was always their hobby. Mum and Dad had beautiful voices. They're still around, actually. Dad's 90th birthday a couple of weekends ago. He can't sing now, but they always saw my success as part of their
legacy.
What they'd handed down, I guess. And what they did, my dad taught me to play ukulele when I was a little kid. He played banjo in the local band, all just voluntary farmers playing. My uncle played fiddle. But they both had their voices trained by the best teacher they could find in a bigger town, because we're in a really little town, Quambatook. Mm. They used to sing Jeanette McDonald, Nelson Eddy, songs that a lot of the young ones don't even know we're talking about, but songs from old musicals. And I think they actually still probably find my Aussie accent a bit funny to handle too. They're still a bit too close to home.
Do they? Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Because of what they were listening to and what they were
raised it's still on. A bit raw for them, a bit close to home, I think,
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? I mean, so you mean you were raised on the farm, you were raised with, you know, farming folks who had a musical bent and a theatrical bent. What other influences would you actually say have kind of been formative for you? Even in terms of that doggedness to actually keep on going, I'm going to be who I am. I'm not going to fit the market.
I don't know where that came from. I think probably my mother as much as anything. She was probably one of the first women's libbers in the district. You know, she always stood up for herself and didn't just do what dad wanted her to do. And she always managed to build nice homes over the years because they moved from there up to the northwest of New South Wales. We started in the Mallee and now they retired in Moree, but we had went onto the land up north of Moree, and she was always determined to have good homes. And when I think a lot of the women around didn't, so I think I think she got her own way, and maybe I hope I have her energy. You know, I think I've got her energy. She's 87 now, and you've talked to her on the phone. She still sounds 50. You know, she's got one of those energetic, positive attitudes to life. So I think I get the push from her, and probably and Dad's talent as much as anything. Yeah. I got a lot of rhythm from him. That's if anyone sees me perform, I'm really a musical drummer as far as my instrument's concerned. That's the way I look at it. I have a guitarist who plays Cole Watson, who plays the lines and stuff. But I tend to play rhythm. If you listen to my guitar, it's like a drum or it's like a cymbal, and I create the rhythm. And I've got the foot box, the stomp box, with both feet. So it eliminates a drummer, and that's one of the best things I've ever done.
Very financially efficient too.
Drummers are hard to handle. They're usually too loud, and they take twice as long as everybody else to set up.
Wasn't it the bass players though, or the aspiring guitarists who never quite made it though?
I've got a lot of respect for bass players.
Of all instruments, I actually really love bass. But isn't that the thing that goes around in musical circles or something?
The drummers usually they knock the banjo players. But and if you've got a big enough sound system, everyone's surprised that you bring a big system in just for two of us, but that's what it is. You get that warmth from the kick
and power.
Yeah.
This is Open House right across the nation. John Williamson is our guest tonight. Now, John Williamson, the larrikin, John Williamson, the multi-purpose, all-purpose band, John Williamson, the musical activist, you've actually taken on a number of causes through your music. Obviously, there's been the environmental issue. Mm. Very, very close to your heart. Coming from being a farming boy, or just from what you've seen as you've travelled?
Well, it's both. I being brought up on the little river, that flooded originally, actually, the little Avoca River, Quampadook. We actually lived on the river, and I became a bird lover when I was a little kid. We used to collect birds' eggs, but we did the right thing. You only take one egg out, but that out of a nest if it was a native bird. But that was a way that I learnt, you know, how they nest, where they nest. At that stage, I was more into birds than I was actually into the bush. But as I got older and we moved to the northwest into a completely different country altogether as wheat farmers, I fell in love with the bush up there. It was just so much more varied than the Mallee, which seemed to be all the same trees, basically. But now I know there was a bit more variety there because the older I've got, the more I've got into our bush. But and we cleared country up there. We moved into some areas that were ringbarked maybe 80 years before, but they left shade trees, whereas us wheat farmers come up and just leave the shade lines on the fence. And I got to a stage where I thought, hang on, Dad, I don't want to knock any more of this down. It's beautiful. Just leave 10% of it. And most people didn't. And then I started to see people clearing bush west where the rainfall wasn't, you know, and then the cotton industries moved in, and I, being actually right amongst it, I could see what was happening to our beautiful bush, and you know the things that used to be there, like red-tailed black cockatoos, were gone, and we're losing. Didn't have the emu, and I have got emus because they like the wheat country anyway, and the kangaroos don't mind it either. But just the whole variety of things are being demolished, you know, in areas where you farm. And that's where it's strange that a farmer should become worried about the bush, you know.
Indeed, because often it's actually the farming community that aren't as vocal about these kinds of things.
Mm. Yeah, but there are people. I've got my brother out there feels the same way. So he's got parts of his farm, you know, that he protects. And even though there is more laws have come in, of course, then the farmers get worried that they can't do anything, you know, so the guys can swing the other way. But then, and then, of course, going into this business, I started to get around Australia a lot more, already fallen over with the bush and realising the variety of the bush everywhere, you know, like every change of soil, you get different vegetation. That comes from being a farmer. We used to actually pick our soil by the trees. You know, Briglow, Blair, Wilga country around Moree is the best soil, you know, and that sort of thing. And and then, you know, slowly but surely, I started to see things in the forest that are owned by us were being completely demolished for wood chip. And so, I, you know, my way of protesting was to write a song. So Rip Rip Wood Chip was actually very effective in the fight against clear felling, you know. So
are you accepted amongst the farming community in general then? Because there'll be some that won't agree with some of these things you're talking about.
Yeah, well, I've knocked the cotton industry a bit too, you know, because they actually don't even leave a tree on a fence, you know. It just turns it into a billiard table, which would have had millions of different species of animals and birds on it, you know, that kind of thing. I have been, they're aware that I have my opinion. But the thing is, what you got to know in Australia is that Aussies do respect your opinion if it's fair dinkum one. It, you know, some people try to say, oh, you're just jumping on the wagon or the greenies have got in your ear or something. I say, no, I'm getting in other people's ears, not me, people getting to my ear. I really know what the bush is and I know what I love and I know what we've got to save. To me, that's our greatest heritage is the variety of the wildlife and bush in this country. And that's what can bring us all together, because it was all here before any of us, including the Aborigines. And, you know, that's a common bond for everybody. It doesn't matter where you started from. When you get that love, I think everyone comes together. You know?
That notion of the land is so important, obviously, for a number of people, the Indigenous Australians, for singer-songwriters like yourself. Is there any spiritual component to that for you? We spoke to somebody recently who went and studied some of the great artists and actually made the point that whether it be Jackson Pollock or Hemingway or whatever, their best work came actually when they had a retreat to nature, and then they kind of became, in many ways, they became pantheists. Now, coming from a Christian perspective, you know, I can see the creation and say it's something of a reflection of the creator who made it. Is there any kind of philosophical, spiritual connection for you?
Well, to me, there's obviously, there is a controlling spirit up there, but I don't look, it's not an old man with a grey beard or a white beard, or I don't think there's any personal connection. I think there is just a amazing natural power out there. I mean, to watch a grub turn into a butterfly, or and all the amazing things of the way a grevillea taps a honey eater on the head and puts pollen on its head so it then cross-pollinates. I mean, what an amazing thing nature is. I mean, it just never stops blowing me away. But that to me is just life, surviving for life's sake, and that is a power in itself. And as far as the spiritual thing, I've always said I don't think God is love. I think love is everything. You know, you can call it God or whatever you like, but that's the only logical way that the world comes together, is caring for one another, and basically all the things that love covers. And all sorts of religions try to own that, but I think it belongs to us all. No matter how you've been brought up, that's the thing that really is the only saviour of it. And I don't think it has to come through Christ or anybody else. I just think it's a natural, logical thing.
Any ideas as to where it came from, though? You know, in terms of origins,
why does
origins
it have to come
of love?
From anywhere? I mean, why isn't it just is, you know? A plant grows, you know, you can't explain why it grows. It's obviously heading for the light, and the roots are heading into the earth for nutrients, and probably gravity's got something to do with it, but I don't see it as... If there was a personal attachment, well, you know, I wouldn't feel too good if I was in Christchurch at the moment. You know, why does your wife get buried in a bunch of rumble? Not because you didn't pray for it or something. I don't get that.
In terms of the pain that is actually, and it's the classic thing, isn't it? You know, why is there pain? Why are there actual natural disasters and things like that? Of course, you know, various worldviews have some answers for that, including the Christian worldview. It talks about a fallen creation, a broken creation needs to be rebuilt.
Well, I think the only reason the building fell down and in Christchurch, I'm seeing them on a screen now through the window there, is because the building was built on a fault. And that, you can't stop nature. Nature hasn't got a brain for Pete, but I don't think nature thinks about us as individuals. It's just nature has survived for its sake. So, I mean, if it was an animal, the animal wouldn't build there again. Of course, they don't get it right all the time either. You know, you've got a kookaburra's nest in a dead tree and it falls over. You know, that's got nothing to do with any... I think it's just, you know, we're living with nature and we're in nature. And if we think we're above nature, well, that's when we're in trouble, you know, I think. And if you're going to build a house right on the riverbank that's been known to flood, well, it's got nothing to do with God or anybody else. You built the house on the river where it's going to flood, you know.
You can't take that away from the conversation, can you? It's got to be part of your thinking, indeed.
You've got to build the house that withstands a flood, you know.
You don't see, though, that, you know, the beauty that you reflect in your work, the beauty actually has got some sort of reflection beyond nature to maybe somebody who is actually over nature or has created nature in the first place?
No, well, I think the reason a flower blooms red is to attract a honey eater. It's not for us to admire. I think it's beautiful because it's attracting. It's the reason for it, to attract things, you know. Mm-hmm. That's why it happens. And yeah, because I appreciate the beauty of it. Like, I can't imagine anyone appreciating the beauty of nature any more than I do. I paint, I take photos non-stop up in the mountains, you know, in Queensland, and that's why I'm there. I'd be completely happy. If something happened and I couldn't play anymore, I would just be very happy to just go up there and retire and muck around with rocks. And they're all things you can take advantage of, but a big rock could fall on my head, and the only reason that would happen is because they've been falling down there for years. And if I get buried in rocks, it's got nothing to do with it. I haven't been praying or anything. It's just the fact I'm working in a dangerous area.
Fascinating to talk to you about these things. Open House is what you're listening to, and John Williamson is our special guest tonight. John Williamson, then the Republican. In fact, you actually got banned from a number of RSL.
No, only one. That's
oh, just a, one,
that's
was
a
it?
Vicious rumour.
The flag of our nation song.
Flag of our own. Flag, yeah, of our, it was just own. One.
It was just one.
And the others suggested that I wouldn't ask, well, I wouldn't sing that song or put the flag up in the club, but they don't worry about it.
It's not as bad as the rumour actually is.
No, right. Well, it was just the Inverell RSL, and they've forgiven me, and I've been back there.
You've been back, okay. Yeah. All relationships.
The Rip Rip one's a bit different in Bigger RSL. No, Eden RSL. They've got a lot of wood chippers customers, and they won't have me back.
They won't have you back at all.
No.
Again, I wanted to ask this question. Again, a musician has to get his or her work money from somewhere, and where you actually take a stand on some things and lose some work as a result, lose some popularity, don't get invited back to the RSL clubs or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I love this country so much, and same with the flag thing. I get probably more bad reactions about the flag than anything because they say, oh, their dad or son died under the flag. But if they died for Australia, well, then the Union Jack's not that important as far as I'm concerned, you know. Now, there is a tradition there, and I got no reason to, you know, I have no problems with RSLs flying the existing flag and the Union Jack before that forever, you know, to represent the people that have fallen under it. But I still think it's a shocking advertising campaign to be putting up the Union Jack every time. The New Zealand flag is hardly any different. You know, Hawaii's got the same. They're still British ensigns, and I think after a couple of hundred years, surely we're not a colony, and that's what the flag says.
You've designed a couple of alternative flags.
Well, I've stuck with the last one now. I call it the True Blue flag, and that's what it is. It's and it's the same pattern as the Territory, I reckon, are the most proud of their flags because the Territory flag hasn't got the Union Jack in the corner, right? It really is a Territory flag. It's got the Southern Cross on the black background, and then it's got the red ochre background with the desert rose, and they're so proud of their flag. I bet if you ask a Queenslander, and you're a Queenslander, I can ask you, what's on the Queensland flag?
We've got the crown, haven't we? With that little
is
crown.
That all?
Let me think now. It's
there
been
you
a
go,
few
folks.
Years now.
They're proof.
It's been a few years.
What's on the Queensland flag?
I've just failed the
I
test.
I bet if you asked any Territorian what was on their flag, they would come up with it straight away. Yeah, well, you've got some sort of a cross. Is it some sort of a cross?
Yeah, there is
with a crown in the middle.
Yeah.
And the Union Jack. So where's Australia in there?
Mm.
And Queenslanders pride themselves on being so Australian or so Queensland. Well, they should have a cassowary or something that's unique to Queensland on with the Southern Cross, you know?
So what do you think Australian
culture... I
could ask
the same question in New South Wales too, I might add.
Yes, indeed. So what do you think, at this point in time, what do you think that Australian culture most needs to recover, or what do you think we're in most danger of losing in terms of our very identity, our very soul?
Oh, I'm not worried about that. It just embarrassed me, you know, at the Olympics and that. You know, actually, in the march at the front of the Olympics, you know, anyone marches out, the English don't fly the Union Jack at all. They fly a red cross on the back, on the white background, the St. George cross. Have you noticed that? And the Scots fly the St. Andrew's cross, which is the white cross on the blue, which is all in part of the, you know, part of the Union Jack.
Hmm.
And the Irish probably fly something else. Well, they've got a flag. And how come, and we fly theirs? Doesn't that, it gets to
I
be.
I love people's thoughts on this. 1-300-40-2020. Let's set the cat amongst the pigeons, John. John Williamson is our guest. Okay, well, what you're doing at the moment is you've been doing, there's a couple of things. One is there is a tour, but also you've done this new album with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra with, I guess, some of your classic songs with their touch, and it's beautiful.
It's raining on the rock. In a beautiful country, I'm proud to travel this big land as an aborigine.
interesting, that lyric there. I'm proud to travel the land as an Aborigine. There's actually been a change in lyrics there, hasn't there?
Yes, well, the hit version was with my original mate, Warren H. Williams. But if you think as an Aborigine, it's also saying I'm as proud as an Aborigine. So it's a double meaning, really. And I'm a sixth generation Aussie, so as far as I'm concerned, you know, I am Indigenous too. You know, I don't feel like I'm anything else. I'm an Australian. So, you know, I don't mind being called a white Aborigine.
So the...
White Indigenous.
So what is it
and
like?
And Aborigines don't mind me saying that.
Right.
They understand what I mean, you know.
So you do your regular shows, your regular gigs with your Stompbox and everything, then you go and do something with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra.
Scary. Yeah, well, I only had one rehearsal on the same day as that recording. We rehearsed in the afternoon. I usually have a nap before my show, not rehearsing with a Sydney Symphony Orchestra in the Opera House. And on top of that, we filmed it and recorded it, so the pressure was on. And till I die, I'll wonder how I did it without mucking it up, you know. in fact, the second half, I got relaxed, and then I did muck it up. I ended up finishing, and it's a song that I'm going to do for you later, the Cunnamulla song. I finished before the orchestra. In other words, I left out a whole verse. And I couldn't believe it. And it took a while for me to work out what I'd done wrong, but we actually used the blooper on the DVD, so everyone has seen this, thinks it's fun because the...
But see, that's also a part of
Guy Noble came down with the music and said, here it is. I'm looking at the music. I don't know what the music means anyway. You know, I wrote the thing, and he looked at my drink and sniffed it. I always have a mug of water. So he made quite a thing of funny thing out of it.
And that's important, though, isn't it? I mean, it's something as stately and as beautiful as the Opera House, where you do expect perfection, and yet actually muck-ups and, you know, it's just part of actually being human, let alone being Australian, and actually, you know, having a bit of a dig at yourself.
And they weren't. I mean, I still did Boogie With My Baby without the orchestra, and, you know, the silly song. And in fact, the orchestra all said that they loved it, that they get a little bit tired of playing the same things, you know. This was something different for them, and they got right into it.
And you've got more kind of collaborations like that coming up, haven't you?
We're doing the Queensland Symphony Orchestra in March 19th. I can't tell you when the Melbourne one is, but it's with
May?
August. Yeah, that'd be it. Orchestra Victoria, that it's called. It's not the actual Victorian Symphony Orchestra. August, there's another one. And then later on, we're doing Tasmania as well. But, you know, that's just sort of part of this 40-year celebration. I don't see myself doing too much of that afterwards. I want the Sydney people to know that I'm actually doing a small gig, a really small one, in 99 on York, which is right in the middle of Sydney. And I'm doing it four Thursdays from April, May, June, July, and they're all like April 21st is probably the only one you need to think of. That's the first one.
Okay.
I've already done a few on in January, but I want to create an Australian place for people to come overseas, and they ask, you know, want to see something Australian. What is there? You know, they go down to the rocks and maybe see colonial stuff or something, but this is modern day Australian music.
Look Out Cunnamulla is the song you're going to be doing for us in the studio here. Just give us an intro for it.
In July last year, in 2010, we had our show postponed, and it was Roma, Charleville, Warwick and Cunnamulla because of the water that was coming through, and it did actually flood Charleville and Roma. That was the first. So, you know, obviously that's disappointing for me, disappointing for the audience. You just couldn't get into the town, basically. But instead of grizzling about it, I thought, I'm going to write a song about this, you know, that the country music can't get in, and what it's like waiting for the water to come, which happened to me when I was a little kid in Quambatook, and it happened recently again, where everyone gets together, and it's quite a bonding thing, you know, but nowhere near, of course. Then, of course, along came the disastrous flash flooding and everything else. But the song still, I wanted to celebrate the fact that the water is so good for the country, you know, and now we're starting, now that we've got through the disastrous side of it a bit with the news, people are starting to celebrate the fact that the wildlife is breeding up like mad, the bird life is breeding up like mad, the salt is being washed out into the ocean right down through South Australia, and it's just going to be so good for the country. Mm-hmm. So whilst there's been a lot of things bad for the country, there's also a lot of good things. I'm not saying it's balanced, but, you know, we have to have floods. We have to, you know. Things will be good for a long time now.
John Williamson, and the song is Look Out Cunnamulla, and johnwilliamson.com.au for more details. John, we'll let you do your thing. Thanks for joining us in Open House.
No worries, Sheridan.
Open House.
on its way. Spin through Roma, Charleville, it can't be far away. Better check the levee banks, fill the bags with sand. Drop everything, it's hands on deck, cancel all you planned. Was it just a month ago, same old drowdy weather, thinking it would never come, praying all together, looking at those empty clouds and disappointing news, comparing flood to dust storm, I know it's what I choose. Now think about the glory of the river flowing strong, the celebrating bird calls, surely can't be wrong. Forget the country music show, they won't be getting in. Forget that game of football, the one we had to win. Forget the wedding in the church, unless we go bare feet. Grab the oars and dinghy, we'll be rowing down the street. Was it just a month ago, same old drowdy weather, thinking it would never come, just you and me together. Looking at those skinny sheep and dying kangaroos, comparing flood to dust storm, I know it's when I choose. Now think about the glory of the river flowing strong, the celebrating bird calls, surely can't be wrong. So look out Cunnamulla, the water's on its way. Through Roma, Charleville, it can't be far away. Better check the levee banks, fill the bags with sand. Drop everything, it's hands on deck, cancel all you plan. Cancel all you plan. Cancel all you plan.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.